This is WOBC Oberlin, 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. I'm Owen Anderson, and with me is Jamie Yu. Today, we are discussing a new album called Black in My Own Way by the DX Experiment, featuring the distinguished actor, musician, and Oberlin alumni, Avery Brooks. We're joined by Dante Xavier, the composer and producer of this album. Visit www.harpspacehappening.com for streaming links and a free download of liner notes for the Black in My Own Way album by the DX Experiment. Dante Xavier is a multifaceted artist, poet, multi-instrumentalist, and composer. He has created hundreds of abstract paintings, collages, sculptures, and photographs, as well as written hundreds of poems. He is also a master of over 30 instruments, including guitar, bass, piano, drums, and percussion. Dante is light-skinned, identifies as Black, and is actively part of the Black community. Dante has studied music with several notable musicians and has developed his own innovative compositional format and performance concept called sentence structure. Urban Elixir, from the album Black in My Own Way, is Dante's first compositional piece using the sentence structure concept. Dante has also composed several works in another new concept called Blues Raga for future release. Hello, Dante.
Hello, how you doing, Owen?
I'm good. How are you? Jamie, you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Were you going to say something, Dante?
No, I was just going to say hello to Jamie. That's all. I didn't want to leave her out.
So, Dante, I thought it would be good to start you. I mean, you started right away yesterday telling us the story of how kind of the impetus for this album. Do you think you could begin to say a little bit about that today?
Sure. I was about 19, 20 years old. I was watching this show on television, one of those shows like 2020 or something like that, and they were showing this piece on this terrible event that had taken place somewhere in the South. These white men decided to hitch a Black man to the back of their pickup truck and drag him through the town. And that just stuck with me for the longest time. To this day, I still try not to imagine it, but you know, it invades your thoughts sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I knew I wanted to do something or make a statement. And then as things seem to be happening in the past few years, especially the past couple of years, the escalation of things happening, I felt that it needed to be said now. So I just composed this actually over a weekend. It kind of almost wrote itself. I know people say that cliche all the time, but it really did just flow out of me. I guess being so sensitive to things like that, injustice has always been something that's just not sat well with me. I guess it just flowed out of me in that way. Interesting thing that I've come to realize, I call this project Black in My Own Way because first means that exactly, to be Black on your own terms. Basically, for the Black community, for us to be able to have the same opportunities and basically social sanctuary, you know, mm-hmm. without fear of artificial interference. By that, I mean law enforcement using this whole dystopian authoritative approach. I'm not saying that all police officers are bad. Of course not. That any more than anybody is bad. But it just simply means that law enforcement as a institution has really failed society, and specifically the Black community. Mm-hmm. And really symptomatic of a larger problem, America has failed the Black community for forever. I think it's just kind of like saying that we are not going to live our lives on the B side anymore. I mean, America is a great country until you read the fine print. We were also talking yesterday about how the 50s and people talk about that as the good old days in the 40s. Right. And the good old days for whom? If you were a woman, they weren't the good old days. If you were a Black American, they weren't the good old days. Right. I'm sure for the American Indians, they haven't been a good old day for a long time. So it depends on who you ask, the good old days. And actually, is interesting because Black in My Way, I've come to find out from different people who've listened to it and have commented to me, seems to mean different things to different people. You know, gay people can relate to it. More or less, acknowledge me means that. Acknowledge me, accept me on my own terms for who I am. When I wrote this, I intended it for the Black community to be Black on their own terms. And that's what it meant to me at first, but and still does. But it seems that it kind of goes across the board to anyone, women, whoever, gay people, lesbians. It means something to everyone who wants to simply just be acknowledged and accepted for who they are without fear of judgment or any kind of ramifications for simply being who they are.
Right. I really appreciate that insight because something that I was talking about yesterday too was how I feel like the way Black in My Own Way, the title and both how people have interpreted it, it's more of a unification in the community through Black culture. And that I feel like maybe like network news or the media tends to politicize identities based on how they're treated in society. But I really do think it's far more than that. When you're within that community, I don't think people like to relate to others through like, oh, hey, we've been through these terrible experiences in history. Instead, it's more like we celebrate this really vibrant culture. And I think that art and music are ways to express that. And I think it's a really important message.
Yes, I just want to say, I think the way you expressed that as it being across the board and through the Black experience, that was very well put. I couldn't have said that better myself. I just want to add, based on what you're saying about that, another thing that we need to address and look at, I think, is the story that we tell. Because the story we tell is the story we're going to live. And as I actually was saying to you yesterday, that I believe that honoring things is one thing, and that's great. Great things that were done in history and great events that happened should be acknowledged. But I don't see anything constructive about remembering things and rehashing things and living things that happened that were not exactly pleasant in the first place. And remembering them is telling the same story. And if you want things to change, then you have to tell another story. As long as, for example, the Black community, as long as we are telling this story of injustice and wanting to be freer and treated in the way that we are supposed to be granted as American citizens, that's all fine to want that. But then instead of telling stories about instances where it's not being done, imagine it the way you want it to be as a community. If you have everyone in the Black community, imagine everyone thinking this positive thought at one time and the power of that. Actually, John Lennon had this idea back in the 60s when he wrote the song All You Need Is Love. He wanted that song to be broadcast throughout the whole world at one time. So he thought that if he could get the whole world thinking about love at one moment, the amount of energy that that would create would just be astounding. And that's what he wanted to do. I don't think it ever came to be the way he wanted it to, but that was the original idea. And so imagine if the whole of society just decided to stop being in this story that we live in and tell another story, a story of what we could be, of what we all are entitled to as human beings. Forget about Black, white, or anything else, as human beings.
Yeah, and that's what I really love about this project as a whole, because you were talking about how it comes from such a place of passion, and I can really tell because it just like it has such a timely message. It sounds so authentic, and it comes from a genuine place, and I can really tell.
It's the love of the Black community, yes, but it's the love of humanity too. And like I said about police officers, not every police officer is a bad person, and I'm not trying to say that. This project is not trying to say that. It's simply trying to say that the institution of law enforcement is not serving the community on a even keel and is not serving justice to everyone the way it's supposed to. In particular, the Black community is victimized left and right. There was an article just yesterday about a sheriff shooting a Black man going into his own house in the back. Mm-hmm. So apparently we're not there. The law enforcement has a problem, and the Black community seems to be a victim of a loophole in the society. And we keep falling through that loophole, and it's kind of like Alice going through the rabbit hole, you know, and we find ourselves in this dystopian place. I'm not, you know, saying for better or worse, it just is.
Yeah. Dante, I want you to talk a bit more about this, what you're saying of this piece, because I think I agree with what you're saying, is that this, what you're trying to put out there in this work is so of the moment. And I'm not sure all the listeners will fully realize this unless we tell them, because I want you to talk about what you told us yesterday of the recording process of this album and the people involved in it, of how it resonated with them and how humanly it was of the moment. Can you talk about that?
Sure. What do you think? First of all, let me just explain sentence structure a little bit. Sentence structure is a way of performing on your instrument where you are creating the flow and feel of a sentence, not per se trying to speak words through your instrument like a Charlie Brown thing. It's more the flow and feel of a sentence, and it had to be spontaneous and in the moment, like a conversation happens as we're talking here. We're mm-hmm. not rehearsing this. I'm not reading from a script or such thing like that, because I have no idea what you're going to say next, so I have to respond in that moment in kind. And so sentence structure is just like that, where, you know, if you're going to have a conversation, it needed to sound like a conversation would naturally flow. So mm-hmm. this had to be done in one take. I wanted to get their initial reaction, you know, to what was going on, to this project, to what was being said when they hear the spoken word and listen to that lyrical content and listen to that. Well, we could talk about Avery Brooks later, but that voice, that's that voice. Yes, that's the voice. When you listen to that voice and to hear their response immediately to that, I didn't want them to, because, you know, you say you're not going to do it. As musicians, we think we're not going to do it, but you get in there and you think, I'm going to do it again, but and I'm not going to think about what I did before. But you do, because, you know, you're thinking like, oh, I really liked what I did there. But you see, the difference is when you did it there, it was something that was coming from his heart. You were speaking what you were feeling at that moment. To do it now, you're mm-hmm. just trying to respond to what's going on around you now, as opposed to really just emoting what's coming from your soul. So that's never going to ring true. So I told everyone, I said, you know, this has got to be done in one take. And we had a couple of phone conversations about things. And everyone was given the spoken word as a script, because, you know, they needed to read this as their script, because you can't play a character or a part unless you've read your script. So they needed to read this and just absorb this as if they were going to act out a play, which is basically what we're doing here. Avery was reading the spoken word, but as opposed to poetry readings where they may have a band there and the band is just kind of comping. I don't know if you know what comping is. It's short in music terms for complimenting. Mm-hmm. You know, you're just playing little things underneath to kind of support what's going on in the text of the moment of what they're reading. But that isn't what this was. When you're listening to the instrumentation going on around Avery, it's not simply backing him. What they're doing in essence is they are reciting the spoken word along with him. So you're getting to hear the musicians interpreting this work simultaneously as Avery is reciting this himself.
Right.
And so now you're hearing two sides of this thing, creating a more of a...
Yesterday, I think you said a true musical.
Yes, a true musical and a more substantial three-dimensional experience for the listener, just that they are in that moment with the artists that are playing, because it's happening at that moment and you're listening to a live conversation, and you can feel if you really listen. And actually, as we said yesterday, you said yourself, every time you listen to it, you hear things that you didn't hear before. And 5 years from now, you'll hear things that you didn't hear now, because you'll be in a different place in your own evolution, and you're hearing this conversation going on in that moment, and you're hearing a thought being conveyed. If you really listen to this, you'll hear thoughts being conveyed between these musicians. They're not just playing babble. There's a connection that happened immediately as soon as we went in there. All the musicians were scared to death, because they had never most of them hadn't ever played before without some kind of a written chart for them. Black in My Own Way is a formalized piece of music. There's no written score, but it does have a score. It's just not written out in notes. And this one brother came up to me and he said, I am so nervous. I said, nervous is great, as long as you're not scared. If you're scared, then you're going to be timid, you're going to hold back, and I'm not going to get what I need from you. But he says, I'm plenty nervous, he said, and they were popping. We had M&Ms there because I had the whole thing catered because we were going to be there for a long time. We were there for like, gosh, we thought it was going to take like 3 or 4 hours maybe to do this whole thing. But setup and sound checks, and by the time we got done, we started at 6 o'clock in the evening. We didn't get done until 5 o'clock in the morning. And Oh, yeah. One of the drummers on this project, Kenwood Denard, he had to drive all the way back to downtown Boston at 4 o'clock in the morning, and he had to teach a class at 8 o'clock. He actually teaches at Berklee College of Music in Boston. We recorded this in the countryside of New Hampshire, but he didn't want to go. Nobody wanted to leave. I'm like, I know you guys got to go. I didn't mean to keep you this long. So I said, you can all go, but everybody stuck around because I said, well, we're going to do this other part, like the other surrounding tracks. We did Urban Elixir, and there were certain musicians who everybody played on Urban Elixir, but I had other musicians that played on Urban Elixir that did other parts with me, and we interchanged. Nobody was on every piece except me. So after that, we did a couple other tunes, and everybody just stuck around because they just wanted to hear it. I don't know if you've listened to all the music yet, but there's a piece on there where it's meant to be a interpretation of a drum solo. And basically, the track is called Alphabet Factory. I wrote this whole thing out phonetically, believe it or not. But what I did was I didn't want to write out a thing like that. You know, write the drum solo and now sing this, Kenwood. You know, because I knew if he tried to do that, first of all, you could never do it at a real time pace and really recite all these things. Like what I was writing down were things like boom, chick, chick, boom, chick, chick. Chick, 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 chick-a-boom, chick-a-boom, chick-chick. And you're trying to say all that and read all this and get all that down. It's hard enough to say the things without trying to memorize this whole, you know, whole thing. And I put it into this kind of a format for him that he could just pick and choose what he wanted spontaneously within the context of all the written stuff there. And he just improvised this thing right off the top of his head. He took all the words that I wrote, and I wrote him down in a way, and I gave him a kind of a sensibility of a drum solo, but I didn't write out a drum solo for him to do. And he did the whole thing in one take. It was incredible to watch him. But see, everybody was sticking around, and then all of a sudden, in the middle of this whole thing, I'd love to take credit for it, but I can't. I can't take credit for this. In the middle of the performance, I'm sitting there, I'm playing the drums on this along with him. I'm comping him with the drum kit, and he's doing this whole boom chick chick thing. And all of a sudden, in the middle of it, he just pulls out a jaw harp and starts going, blah, 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 you know, and everybody just starts laughing, just on the floor laughing. Not because it was bad. It was just so, so unexpected and just so, just perfect, you know. It's one of those things where you just can't plan it, you know. And he just pulled the thing out and just started playing. And I looked over and I'm like, whoa, okay, you know, I'm digging this. And then he starts doing this kind of in between the whole jaw harp thing, which I play the jaw harp. I know how difficult it is to just play the thing alone. And he starts doing this whole vocalese thing on top of the jaw harp. You know, he starts just going do 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 do. This whole thing, he just starts doing this, and it's just like, wow. And this is all spontaneous, and we never rehearse this thing. And that's why I don't rehearse things, because you don't get things like that if you rehearse things. You never get things like that. And you don't get a second chance at something like that. So thank God the tape was rolling.
Mm-hmm. That all sounds really great, and just how the benefits of just those kind of organic things happening can lead to such unexpected surprises. But I actually wanted to pull back a little bit. And so you had like a kind of a non-traditional way of putting together this album with like minimal rehearsals and
no rehearsals
and these kinds of spontaneous events happening. So how did you go about selecting these musicians who were kind of willing to put themselves out there like this and just dive in with no rehearsals?
Actually, it's very much like the way I chose Oberlin as the first people that I have spoken to about this in any kind of an interview, formal tense, if you will. And the same way with the musicians, some of these musicians are known. They've done things like Kenwood Denard has played with lots of people. I'm not one for dropping names. In fact, my whole bio that you spoke about at the beginning, which thank you very much for that.
It is a very humble bio, by the way. It does not include everything.
I tried to keep it to the very basics. And and not colorize it in any way. I just wanted it to be the core truth. These are the things I do, and that's not a big deal. I do them. And the same thing with these musicians, like with Kenwood. He's played with people like Aretha Franklin, James Brown, Maceo Parker, who played with James Brown, Bootsy Collins, Whitney Houston. He's an incredible musician and an incredible person, and I'm proud to call him my friend. I asked him to do it, and he pretty much said, yeah, I'm there for you.
There's some big-name people that just heard the project and went, oh, yeah, I'm in.
Yeah, yeah. Avery Brooks, I approached him. I didn't have to coax him in any way. He looked at it. He said, this is important. I want to be a part of this, and that was it. But there are people on it that aren't known, mostly people on it that aren't known. I didn't pick people because they were famous. They had to be the right people. For example, like this whole piece is about Dr. King's id, his psyche, and this inner voice that was going on within him. So there are three basses in this playing the part of Dr. King. And each one had their own unique voice. They needed to be spoken in a certain way. The id had to be this kind of a very methodical, logical approach, you know? And the superego had to be this kind of above everything, the cosmic person, you know, that we are, where we all come from. Then the other voice had to be more like the arbitrator, which is the ego played by Mark Wilson in this whole scenario. So everyone was chosen for their voices. The brother who played the id, he was very talkative on his instrument, shall we say. You know, he was a very busy player. And some people might think that's not a good thing, but in this case, it was a good thing. It was exactly what I was looking for. And then I needed someone for the superego to be a more ethereal kind of a, can blend in with everything. And those gentlemen are Kevin Barber and Joe Pirog. They were perfect. They did a great job. And then another person that I had on this that played the acoustic bass is somebody that I, again, another person who is no slouch in his own right. He's an incredible musician.
Mark Wilson.
He's from Texas. He drove all the way from Texas to do this project. Literally, he drove because he did not want to put his bass on a plane.
And, of course.
You know,
of course.
Which I named Big Bertha because this thing is huge. This double bass he's got, it's huge. It's a behemoth. I named her. I said, Bertha's talking, baby. Bertha's talking. Better listen. So he drove from Texas. And believe this or not, he made it from Texas to New Hampshire in 2.5 days. He didn't sleep. I think he took one stop at a hotel on the way, and then he just drove. He drove halfway, slept, and then drove the other half of the way. I'm like, you're crazy. He said, well, I'm going to make sure I was there on time. And he actually got there 2 days early.
I think that is a testament to how excited everyone was to work on this piece and how important it is once you get involved, which is why I hope that everyone that listens to this interview will go listen to the album because it has something for everyone and you can feel the overwhelming...
And it's such a labor of love, I can
yeah,
tell.
Yeah, and it's a mountain of energy that people have put into this. Undoubtedly, Dante has put in everything into this that he can. So, yeah, I think that story is a good testament to the importance that this project has in people's lives.
Yeah, you're making a good point that after we did this project, everyone looked at each other and we all said, we did something pretty amazing here tonight. Something happened here tonight beyond what happened here tonight. And we all felt that and we all knew that no matter what we do for the rest of our lives is ever going to be any more important than what we did here. For everyone on this project, they all emphatically stated to me that this was the best work they had ever done. And they all credit me with pulling it out of them, but I like to say I didn't pull anything out. I feel like Michelangelo, he once said that I don't do anything. I just get rid of what's unnecessary. And what's left over from the rock is what remains. I just got rid of what was unnecessary. I like to think that that's what I did. I didn't do anything. They had it in them. I just gave them an avenue to let it out. It was always there. I didn't do anything. This project turned the light on in them. And I think that there was more than just us in that room that night, if you know what I mean. There was something going on there. There was more than just us in that room. I almost, want to say that maybe Dr. King was there and a few musician friends might have popped in for a quick hello, because I don't know. It was just the way I knew that it was going to work well if they just relaxed into the conversation. But the way things happen, like between Kenwood and I, when you're listening to the Alphabet piece, I just knew where he was going and he knew where I was going. And we just knew there was no conversation. We didn't have to look each other's eyes. Usually musicians like to look at each other so they know what's going on. We didn't do that. We didn't have to. I would go here and it was like it was my left arm that knew what my right arm was doing. And the way that that happens, your left arm and the right arm know what they're doing together. We were like that. Avery looked up from his booth in the live room after he read the first part of Act Three, that whole piece where from cotton fields to battlefields to tenement slums, but still I breathe. He looked up after he read that first part and he said, "I live this." After he said that, I just knew that no matter what, if this project goes over well with the community or not, or if it never sees the light of day, I know that I did something here. That's all that I needed for him to say that, because I just respect Avery immensely, as an artist, as a human being, and as a voice in the black community.
For people listening, I just want to point out what Dante is talking about is that Avery Brooks, who, if you don't know who Avery Brooks is, please look him up. I can't summarize here, but Avery Brooks is featured on the album and performs all the spoken word on the album. So that's what Dante is referring to, just to be clear.
One other thing I did want to point out is that these musicians, all of them, including Avery, had never played together. They didn't even know each other. So that was another thing that was really incredible, that they didn't even know each other, but they settled into that conversation so quickly. You would think that these were old friends just getting back together and talking about old times. It was incredible that they never, ever met each other. So that was another remarkable thing about it. But thank you for pointing out about Avery. Yes, I guess I just, when I talk about Avery, I just assume that everybody just knows how wonderful he is because he's just such a loving spirit and just a great individual. I guess you can tell that I'm very biased about Avery, but I am. I don't mind expressing it because I just think the world of the man. I love the brother. I just, he's just been so supportive of this project and so important to this project and continues to be an inspiration in my life. So I will always be grateful for having the opportunity to work with him and get to know him, and that will always be important to me. Thank you for explaining that for me.
We wish everybody knew. We wish we could assume everyone knows who Avery Brooks is.
Yeah,
But
it's
I
just providing the
just
appropriate context
yep.
for people listening in. But yeah, go look him up. He's great.
We've talked a little bit, well, more than a little bit about how the sound for this album was put together and created. Do you think Dante, you could talk a bit about, for example, the album cover and the YouTube video piece as well?
Sure. There's a couple of parts going on in the album cover. That was taken actually from a photo. I do photography as well. Again, just not to blow my own horn. I felt like, I needed to preface that before I go into this. Because the album cover with that piece that says Made in Germany on it, that was actually a photograph that I had done. And I took that one section of the photograph, actually the whole photograph, I took it out of context and put it in the album cover. And then the album cover, what it's supposed to be, is a room without walls. And the way it was created, I used gradations instead of having a line where walls intersect. No walls intersect. If you look at the piece, all the objects in that room create the walls, the edges for the walls. If you look at that black rectangle, that makes the edge where the walls meet. I used the items in the album cover to create the walls. There's no wall that interlocks like where you see a corner in a wall locking together. It just kind of gradates into a lighter area, to a darker area, and into the gradates down into the floor to make a kind of a floor. But the floor doesn't meet the wall. It's kind of just gradates into the wall. And then if you look over where the Made in Germany piece is, that kind of creates the context for that wall. And what's going on in that piece is the room is supposed to be this room without walls, but then you have that rectangle, which is supposed to be a black hole. And if you look at everything on the Made in Germany piece, I created it in such a way that everything is kind of going on a diagonal and looks like it's going into that rectangle, like it's being sucked into the black hole. There's like a little half round piece on there that comes over by the lips, that comes over into, I'm speaking of the Made in Germany part now, it comes over into the piece there. That's supposed to be the black hole encroaching on everything which is going towards the black hole, and this is the presence of the black hole encroaching on the objects in that photo. What the whole thing with the Made in Germany is meant to be is, again, it's about the police and law enforcement. When I had seen some of these things happening, you know, some of these incidents that have gone on, I'm not going to go into them because, as I said, I don't like to go back to those things. And we all know what happens. We all know the story, and we've all been there too many times. And unfortunately, we all know the sad truth of what's going on. And as I've said in my piece, you know, we're all singing another dirge. And
And we don't want to sing another. We don't have to sing one after sing another one.
It was kind of me, basically just me comparing the law enforcement and that whole totalitarian attitude that they seem to have about the black community at large, that I kind of got the feeling like they were like the Gestapo. So I just wanted to say this is not attacking the German community. The Gestapo was from Germany. And so this whole thing was me comparing the police force to the Gestapo and saying basically, Made in Germany. That's where this whole thing in this country started, with the Gestapo, which came from Germany. So Made in Germany just seemed like, you know, a tongue-in-cheek way of saying this thing. And that's what that's all about. And the lips is meant to create this stark reality of humanity and a dystopian Garden of Eden, if you will. If you look at that picture on Made in Germany, that's what it's supposed to create, this desolate, isolated feeling. And that's what the whole album cover is basically about. I hope I got that out clearly enough. I'm not sure. I hope it made sense.
I think it made sense.
But that's the best way that I can think of to explain it. And actually, something else that I wanted to explain, when I said about how I picked the musicians, I said it was very similar to how I chose Oberlin. I didn't want to go through commercial radio. So I looked around, and Oberlin just had, after I was looking into it, I just felt this synergy with this college. I just felt a connection with it, that it just felt like the right way to go. And I knew right away, it was just an intuitive understanding of it. But I kind of just saw this as a kind of a grassroots thing. And I wanted that to happen on the campuses first, so that the young voices coming up need to be the ones who hear this. And they're the ones who really care, I think.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
As I was saying to you yesterday, I think that anything that you want to get out, you know, it's all about belief in anything. The only thing that makes anything real is the belief in it. And that's what I was trying to say when I said about everyone starting to tell a new story. What you believe is at least as important as the way you receive things around you. You have to believe in anything to make it real. The only thing that makes a tree solid, per se, is that we believe it is. I know that sounds crazy, and it's just kind of a way of making a point that, you know, that what we believe is what happens. And I believe in Black in My Own Way, and I believe in society, and the society will rise to the occasion and will do what's necessary when time comes. And I think that people are getting to that point where they're wanting to tell another story and tired of telling this same story of what is. I never look at things directly. I always look at things peripherally and try to get a perspective on my own of what I'm looking at, instead of being directed by what's in front of my eyes. You did mention you wanted to speak about the film. So,
Yes.
if you'd like me to speak to that, I'd be glad to speak to that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So, well, the whole thing with the film, I didn't want to do something that was high tech, because I felt like that's just overdone and it's played out. Everybody is doing that, but mostly I wanted it to be something that was, it was artistic, but I wanted it to be something that served the music, that really it was compatible with the music and was synergy with the music. I have this photograph that I had taken that what I basically did was I had taken this film and I saw this footage and I took this part of the footage that I thought it really touched me, and I saw these kind of like trees and signposts that it created this feeling of like a film strip, like a film. When you look at a film and you have the different slides as they go by. So I saw that in these things and I froze it, it had these like frames like you would have on a film. And so I froze it between these sections and I thought, wow, it's like a film. I took this film and I made it into a photograph, but then by having these sections within the photograph, it brought it back to a film state, if you will. And so at the time I did this, I didn't really quite know how it was going to fit in with things, but I knew it was going to fit in some way. And then it came to me to make this kind of a looping film out of this thing, which would create this repetitive scene of this, what I consider to be this urban tense reality, which is part of what the whole project is, but it's part of the Urban Elixir piece. And it just seemed that that was the urban tense reality to me in that picture there. Just with that woman dragging that cart with the child behind her, it just seemed that was it. I wanted to ingrain this in the people that were watching, but mostly I wanted it to be something that wasn't going to distract from the music, but yet enhance the listening experience and kind of more or less be a visual of what you're feeling at that moment when you're listening to the music. So I had this looping thing going on, but then I also had this section of the film where it says, "We're experiencing technical difficulty, please stand by." I didn't just do that to be funny. That was meant to more or less take everyone out of this reality, this urban tense reality for a moment and distract them and then bring them back into it again, just to kind of create, this tension and release sort of a thing. And also just to give them something else to look at, I guess. But mostly to create this distraction and, to take them out of that reality for a moment. I think that sometimes you have to do that to people anyway. Just to take people out of where they are just for a moment, to get them on another track, just to break up things and get people to see a different perspective for a moment. And that's what I'm trying to say here, is that to take them out of that reality was to distract them and to get them out of their own reality that they were in, and now bring them back into this reality when they go back again to the urban tense reality of the film. Now they have been distracted, so now they go back into this, and their mind is clear now, and they now get pulled right into this reality now, and then it allows that urban tense reality to be ingrained in their minds. At the end of this piece, I took the film that I had been chopping up into these pieces, if you will, and at the end, I put the photograph back together and I froze it like that. It just seemed like the perfect way to end this, like going to a movie where they just end it and it freezes there in the scene. Yeah, that's what I was trying to create here, this frozen scene, but also to bring it back so that now the people that were watching this art film can have a reference and a context of what they were looking at as a whole piece now, and they could put the whole piece together and see what they were, they were getting these little frames of in the film. Now they can see the whole thing as one reality. And I just thought, to stop it there like that and look at that woman. If that doesn't break your heart, then I don't know what will.
Thank you so much for explaining that. I think we talked about something yesterday that the listeners would also, it would be good for them to understand. If you could talk about Alpha Body, what that is to you, Because I'm not sure everyone will understand, it'd be good if they should, if they would, because it appears on the album a couple times.
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah. Great. The Alpha Body, first of all, is for me, it's an instrument. First and foremost, the instrument is that it's my body, that I'm playing on my body. And it's more or less the Alpha Body. That's how I identify with my body or with the human body as the Alpha Body. The piece that it's on is called Urban Neon Jungle. So basically, the Alpha Body is my body that I'm playing on. This piece, the Urban Neon Jungle, that I was playing on my body, I was creating this body rhythm, which is supposed to be this organic state, and it was supposed to create this presence for Dr. King within the score that's going on. And I played it with this kind of a somewhat stumbling feel. It's harder than it sounds. You might think that, well, it's easy to just not play steady time and just, mess up the time. But it wasn't just messing up the time. It had to have a time. There was a time going through this, and that it wasn't just simply, random. There had to be a time going through this. It was a stumbling, but there was a time, a definite time going through this. I explained that all actually in the liner notes, which actually I just want to say this, that I do explain all these tracks. Avery commented to me when he first saw the liner notes that my project was the first project he thinks that ever came with an instruction manual, but I felt that it needed that. So I explained all these pieces so that, you can understand exactly what's going on in them and what they're about and how they relate to Urban Elixir and how they create the score around Urban Elixir. But so, as I was saying, though, this piece had a somewhat stumblingness to it to portray Dr. King's struggles. At the same time, I didn't want it to sound like a body rhythm that, just a basic rhythm, a pattern that was done in the studio. I wanted it to feel like this organic experience. So that's why it had to have this stumbling to it to create that feeling of someone stumbling. But yet, when you stumble, like when you stumble, if you're walking down the street and you trip on a crack in the sidewalk, you don't necessarily fall down. You might compose yourself through the stumble and you get back into your stride, but you keep the stride going. And so that's, what I was trying to do here. Keep this, like I said, it had to have a natural flow to it. It did have a time. There was a rhythm itself to it. It had a time feel to it.
Right, you did talk about yesterday about keeping the life in it, as it were.
The funny part about this that I conveyed to you yesterday, Owen, this piece, I wanted to create this echo for it, sound like somebody walking down a corridor or a stairwell.
Yeah, you went to great lengths for
Yes,
this.
yes, yes. So I was with my sound engineer, James, and we were talking about, and I explained what I wanted for this. And he said, "Well, I don't really have anything here, like any kind of a Foley room for you or anything where you can do this." And he said, "The only thing I have is the restroom." And I said, "Okay." And he looked at me, "Are you serious?" "Okay." He says, "Well, now you go in there. I'm not going to see you from the booth. There's no window to the restroom." He says, "We don't have windows in the restrooms." And so that's okay. I'll go in there. I'll count to 10. Maybe I'll wait a little bit longer to make sure you're back and you have the tape rolling. And then I'll start." And so I'm counting, 10 Mississippi, and then I counted another 5 Mississippi, and then I started this rhythm. And the restroom had this great echo to it. It really did. I don't want to make a practice of it, I do some of my best work in the restroom. But that's how it came to be. And that's what the whole Alpha Body is. Me playing on my body and stomping my feet and getting this echo to create this feeling of a corridor, somebody walking down an empty corridor or an empty stairwell. I'm sure you've both walked down empty corridors and you can hear your feet from one end to the other. And that's what I was trying to create with this. Everything I've done in this project, it means something. I just want to point that out, that everything in this project, it means something beyond the esoteric nature of whatever it's called or whatever it's stated as being. It's beyond that esoteric word. So I would let everyone know that there is something to everything that's being stated within this context of this piece, that it means something.
Which brings us back to the idea of this being in sentence structure, I think, right?
Yes, yes. That's why I did that, the whole thing with sentence structure. I could get into the particulars of how it's done, but I did want to share kind of an interesting story about the difficulties that I had with this project when I was going looking for a studio. Again, I'm not sure if Jamie was on when I spoke about this. I think you were, weren't you, Jamie, when I spoke about... Yes, you were.
Yeah.
When I spoke about the sound, the studio owner having voiced some concerns when he heard a specific segment of the project. Let me first preface that there were three white musicians on this project and three black musicians on this project, and then me. The piano player, who was one of the white musicians, he didn't know, didn't put two and two together that it was called Black in My Own Way. He thought, all he knew was, all he knew was it was called, the piece he was working on was called Urban Elixir. And so as far as he's concerned, it's Urban Elixir. Okay. Whatever that means, as far as he was concerned, that didn't mean anything to him, so it didn't bother him. But when I sent all these releases out to everyone for them to sign their work over to me, they have to release their work that they, you know, they performed this project, but they have to release it to me. So I sent it out. One of the things on there, it stated, and how do you want your name to appear on the project? So he calls me up. He says, Dante, I didn't know this is called Black in My Own Way. You know, I don't want people thinking that I'm saying I'm black. So I said to him, do you know any black people besides the people you crossed paths with? And he says, no, I've never sat down before and spoken to anyone like that. I don't have any black friends. And I said, okay. I just wanted to understand why you're so concerned, because, again, nobody else is showing concern here. None of the black folks here, you know, we're not looking at you and saying you're black. You're not saying you're black. You're performing on this project. But that's beside the point. I said, so how do you want to appear? I want to be called Mr. White Keys. That's my handle online. I want to be called Mr. White Keys. And I thought, oh, God, this is perfect. Oh, my God. Mr. White Keys. Yes. You know, I just Black in My Own Way featuring Mr. White Keys. Okay. I'm there. You know, you don't have to ask me twice. You know, my biggest concern was he was going to call up and say, you know what? I spoke to somebody and they convinced me it's not that big a deal. You know, and you guys don't have any problem with me. So, okay. Call me by my name. That was my concern. Please don't change your mind. Please. You know, let me at least get the album to press before you change your mind. Then I can say, well, it's too late now. It's already in print. You know, but he didn't change his mind. He was just scared to death about somebody thinking that he was saying he was black in his own way. It just shows it means different things to different people. And that includes not understanding what it's saying at all and the confusion of it. I didn't really think anybody was going to be confused. I thought it was kind of matter of fact that simply stated, you know, black in my own way. But it never occurred to me that a white person might think, how am I black in my own way? I'm not black. But apparently that was an issue that needed to be addressed. That was just another one of the incidences about this project, that it was difficult in some senses to get a place to do this project in, because the place had to be big enough to fit, you know, seven musicians in there at one time in a live room, and they had to be able to see each other, and there had to be enough room so that I could isolate certain things. Like, for example, all the basses in this project, except the acoustic bass, of course, are not mic'd. There's very little mic'ing in the room. Everything was heard through headphones because I didn't want any kind of crosstalk, you know, bleeding over from one channel to another. So the electric basses are plugged right into the board. And, of course, Avery's going right into the board. The only things that were mic'd that weren't into the board was piano, the drums, of course. because no one knows where I'm going with this. and the bass, the acoustic bass. And so we built this partition, this plexiglass partition around the acoustic bass so that, you know, he could see us. But he was sheltered and shielded from the drums, which had to be near him in proximity because, you know, we had to see each other. And as much as we tried to shield it, it's still bled over. Kenwood is, I should say, he has a hearing impairment. He wears a hearing aid. So he doesn't always hear how loud he sounds. And even with the partition, when I went to mix this, he still bled over into the bassist's microphone. And that's why I'd say James is brilliant. He got this thing and he juggled it back and forth using the Pro Tools and he got it done. And I'm just really grateful that he got that part out of it. So that was another thing about how this whole thing was basically the challenges of recording this thing and having to have a room that was big enough. And even then, as you can see, there were still issues to deal with, but it had to be that way, that everyone had to be in the room. I was emphatic about that. And I was also emphatic that everyone read the script because, you know, if you don't read that script, then you're not going to know what you're playing. And if you don't know what you're playing, then you're not playing from content. You know, sentence structure, you know, a lot of people, when I talk to them about it, one of the things that they think is, oh, it's a jam session. No, it's not a jam session. There's a conversation going on, and it's not just random notes and just, you know, playing whatever machinations might be coming out of your mind. You know, you know, it's not just that. It has to come from content. It's not just gibberish. You don't have to always be playing. There are pauses in conversations, as if, you know, as you've seen right now, you're not speaking, I am. There are pauses, and you don't have to always play, but when you do play, it has to come from content. You have to be saying something. You have to be feeling something and be stating something within the context of the story.
It's tricky because I think people expect it to have the organicness of improv, but it is actually like secretly like a very deliberate way of playing music.
Yes, it is. It's actually what I like to call it as structural reflection. There's no structure to this. I mean, the musicians, I created sentence structure, which I told them what sentence structure is supposed to be, and I left it up to them to, on their own terms, create it. And so, yes, it is structure, but it's not really structure. It's reflecting structure. It's kind of like you put water in a glass, right? Water becomes the glass, but it's only reflecting the structure. But if you take that water and you put that water in a pond now, per se, it can reflect the glass. It can reflect everything around it, but
It takes
doesn't
the
be
shape of its
right.
container.
It takes the shape of its container, but if you take it out of its container and you put it in a pond now, it can reflect everything, but it's not actually becoming structure anymore. It's structure when it's in that glass. It can take the shape or it can take on its own identity. You put water in a glass, it takes the shape of the glass, but if you put a lid on that glass, it can never take the shape of that lid. But if you take it away from the glass, and you put it outside of the glass, now it can reflect the glass and the lid. It can become everything that it sees. So that's what sentence structure is. It's reflecting it, but yet becoming all that it sees, all that it is, all that you are, whoever's speaking in that language. There's a lot more going on there than just notes being randomly shouted out at you.
Because it's not random.
No, it's not at all. But it's randomly conceived, but not randomly expressed. It's expressed with deliberateness, and there was eye contact being made the whole time. Everyone was very relaxed, and at times even just kind of, you know, smiling at each other because they were, because as I said, we kind of felt somebody's there with us, and we're all smiling the whole time. It was just such a happy experience. It was just so much fun to do. You know, like I said, there was just something in the room with us besides the seven of us. All the musicians have been asking me to perform at different places with them. And my friend Mark, who's one of the bass players on this project, he plays double bass. He wanted me to perform this. His wife teaches at the University of Texas and wanted me to perform this at their school. And I emphatically said no because I felt like the whole point of what we did here was spontaneous.
Of
And
the
to go,
moment, yeah.
right, the whole point I'd made you guys not rehearse was because I didn't want this to be this rehearsed preset thing. And if we go and do this now, because we have a reference point now of an album that's been made, no matter what you say, you're going to try and recreate what has been done. And it was done perfect the first time, and you can't capture that again. Lightning in a bottle, you know what I mean? So I said, no, Absolutely not. I won't do this. There is so much to talk about this project,
Right. We'd
but
love to spend more time on
I
it.
think I'd like to maybe state what the musical mission statement of this project is, if you're interested in that.
Please, please
Yeah,
do.
absolutely.
Well, one of the things that I had hoped Urban Elixir would accomplish is the idea that, stating a message, without loud ranting expletives, and shock therapy tactics, and painting these grim urban realities, these images. I watched this video and they showed this black youth being beaten by police and ravaged. I don't think that is constructive. It's not getting us where we want to go. It's not what we want to see. It's certainly not what we want to experience. And it's not helping anyone. My hope is that maybe Black a Mile Away will show that an intelligent approach will always, start with the idea that there is a solution and build on it from there. Not create the idea that we are in this harsh, grim reality and there's no way out. I think that an intelligent approach has got to start with the idea of there is a solution. It starts with the solution. The solution has to be the motif of the whole thing that you build around. And then you go from there. Because if you start out with expletives and all that, you paint yourself into a corner and there's no way out. There's no way out of that. But if you start out with a positive image and also ending with hope, and that's what I think I did with Black in My Way. At the end, Urban Elixir, it has a common motif that pulls itself together. And in the end, that yes, we do have something we can do. There is an answer and there is a solution and it isn't hopeless. And that's what I was trying to get across with my statement, that was the most important thing. If nothing else, I hope that young people, black and white and alike, come across realizing that there is an answer. Black people realizing that we have opportunities and we have alternatives and we have things that we can do. And black people are not the enemy for those that look at it that way. And it's not a threat to anything. Just that it will show people that we are all united by a common thread of humanity, that runs through all of us. We have to find that common thread through us all that binds us together. We're more than this. That's the whole thing that I hope comes from this, if nothing else does.
I think that's an excellent note to end it on. Thank you, Dante. Thank you to everyone for listening. Please go take a look at Black in My Own Way. Support this work that resonates with everybody because it will touch you in some way. And be well.
Thank you so much for your time and your energy and your insight and for speaking to us about this project. And I learned so much while talking to you. So thank you for that as well.
Thank you for having me as a guest.
Listen to the full composition on YouTube or visit www.harpspacehappening.com for streaming links and a free download of liner notes for the Black in My Own Way album by the DX Experiment. Thanks to Dante Xavier, and we look forward to hearing more from him about his upcoming projects.